Big Web Show, everything web that matters. I'm your host, Jeffrey Zeldman. Today's Big Web Show guest is Rachel Andrew, longtime web developer and web standards champion, co-founder of the Perch CMS, and author of Get Ready for CSS Grid Layout, one of the premier briefs from A Book Apart, released just last Thursday and already going viral. Hey, Rachel, how you doing?
Hi, it's great to be here.
Cool, it's really nice to have you here. What's it like finally having a real layout language for the web?
I've been very excited about Grid for, well, about 3 years, really. When I first sort of encountered the IE implementation, the sort of early implementation that that the Microsoft team did. And yeah, I mean, it just felt like this is what we've waited for. And I mean, the spec now is very different to that initial implementation. And a lot more advanced and can do an awful lot more things. But the minute I saw it, I thought, yes, this is the sort of thing. This is the thing that we've been waiting for.
So, for example, it's a CSS language that expects columns, that lives in a world where it knows there are columns.
Yes, yeah. And it knows that there are two dimensions to layout and gives everything, makes everything sort of belong to an entire layout, as opposed to us kind of positioning things individually around our layouts and then everything else not knowing that they're there, and you kind of happen to then move everything around. I mean Grid and Flexbox as well, to an extent, they make things a total layout and mean that the things that are then Flex or Grid items become part of that layout and know about each other. And that's the real difference.
So, I mean, in the history of CSS, it was proposed when most websites were still basically documents.
Yes.
Yeah. And it was proposed as, and it was genius, right? Done, you can't take away from Burt and Hokum. But I don't think multi-column was even, they probably didn't think people would want to read in columns on the, web. And, you know, there weren't that many websites that used sidebars and all that other junk because monitors were very small, so they couldn't imagine it.
Well, that's it. You know, we had these little screens, and really there was very few variations in screen size as well. You know, really, it's like some people had, you know, 10, 24 screens, like massive screens, you know, compared to my first computer, you know, it was a sort of 640, this tiny little pokey screen.
Yeah.
And when I remember sort of CSS coming on the scene and sort of people talking about it, and we were just like, oh, this is great. You know, we don't have to set all of our fonts all over our document anymore.
We'll be able to do that keep
separate file.
I can separate my font tags from the rest of my
table
layout markup. Oh. Yeah,
that was really what it was about.
Did you ever do the hybrid layouts like I did, where you were still sort of using tables for columns and stuff, but trying to use CSS for things like paragraph styling and headline styling?
Yeah. So that was sort of the start. And then, I mean, fairly early on, I started trying to do CSS layout. Dreamweaver had what it called layers, which was actually absolute positioning. Back at the time when you could only position things from like the top and left, you couldn't position things from right and bottom.
Right. Because it was a print model. It was as if there was a fixed.
Yeah.
That's what, and so, you that know, wouldn't be a limitation on paper. That wouldn't be a problem because every page has a top left and, you know.
Yeah, and so sort of trying to do that stuff and dealing with things like the fact that Netscape 4 would stack up all those positioned elements in the corner if you resized it, and like all sorts of, sort of crazy things that would go on.
But absolute positioning, I mean, it wasn't really the right solution anyway.
No.
Leaving aside responsive, which nobody was figuring out yet.
I mean, yeah.
People were doing liquid, but if you were doing liquid layouts, you weren't going to be trying to do real. I mean, the people who were doing liquid layouts generally weren't the people who were trying to design artfully designed pages. They were usually – right. Okay. So the problem with absolute positioning is you said yourself at the beginning, this one knows there are two dimensions. Absolute positioning didn't. And if content started to overflow, you know, content from one absolutely positioned element started to overflow another absolutely positioned element, you had all kinds of problems, which we also had when we used float.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you see all these websites where people obviously designed them, you know, with a certain font size and expecting a certain amount of text, and they'd add a bit too much text, and it would, like, you know, either be cropped off or it'd expand out the bottom of the box and things would be overlapping. And there's all that sort of stuff was fairly normal to see, you
and
know.
I don't know about your clients, but my even if we put them on a CMS, even if we gave them, you know, very finely designed templates that were, you know, everything was tightly controlled, and the CMS said, you know, there were only there were character counts in the CMS data entry boxes, so they wouldn't break the fragile CSS layout. And then they would still find a way. They would insert images in the middle of a paragraph. They would always, every client I ever had would find a way to hack their CMS to make it do what they needed it to do.
Yeah.
Because I hadn't designed a system that anticipated what they might need to do 6 months after, you know. 6 months after we delivered it, there had business needs that had changed, or, you know, we want two thumbnails now. Well,
Yeah, I mean, we were designing for, I mean, you know, I've not got a print background, but even so, we were still designing for print. That's right. That's what we were trying to do. And our sort of tools were essentially sort of, we're almost acting as if that's what we had to do. And that's kind of carried on until very recently, really.
It's that same thing. I love this metaphor too. It's when people started making movies, they thought of it as photography, and then they thought of it as theater, right? Mm. And they would put the camera, and the camera didn't move, and the actors would do things in the middle distance like you were watching a play. And in the silent era, they finally evolved a film language with close-ups and cutaways and everything. And then that all went out the window as soon as sound came in, because the sound cameras were so big and heavy, they had to basically go back to filming plays. But it's the same thing. You start a medium, you think about something that came before and use it as a metaphor until something new comes along.
I feel like with the sort of the new layout stuff that's coming in with Flexbox, with Grid, we've finally got a kind of language to allow web design to really become its own thing, because we've not had that language before. We've not had the ability to really be creative with what we're doing. You know, we're trying to kind of hack our way around things that just aren't really designed for what we're trying to do with them.
Well, which is one reason frameworks are so popular. There's all these layout frameworks that where the markup is totally not semantic. It's like millions of columns, implied columns, and you know. And the people aren't doing that because they're evil. They're doing that because they want to do something sophisticated.
They've got to get the job done. You know, we're running businesses, and you know, I think, you know, I've said before, you know, how concerned I'm about the sort of rise of all these frameworks, and people are just sort of starting with those and actually not learning the core skills.
Right. It's like starting with Dreamweaver.
Yeah, exactly. It's exactly the same argument we had then. You know, you shouldn't be starting with Dreamweaver. You should be using Dreamweaver as a tool to help speed up what you're doing. And it's the same with the frameworks. If you know what you're doing with them, then they can speed up a lot of stuff. They can help you work in a team. They can do all, you know, there's a lot of good around a framework, and I'm certainly not bashing them. It's the fact that there are a lot of people who only know Bootstrap, or, you know, they don't actually understand how CSS is working underneath that.
As hard as we worked, but instead of learning like a new CSS, they're learning a new framework. They're like, you only know Bootstrap? I know 20 frameworks, so I can do anything. And it's like, how about learning Bootstrap and then learning CSS? Right? Do you think that Grid Layout and Flexbox have the potential to, I don't want to say like, get us past this framework's time?
I hope so. I think there'll always be where frameworks really, really work is where they help to standardize what you're doing as a team, where they help you standardize what you're doing across a site or across lots of sites that your company builds. And that's a good use of them. The problem with a lot of them at the moment is the fact that they are just so sort of conceptually heavy. You know, you have to use an awful lot of markups to describe the sort of grid systems and things. And there are ways around that. You know, you can use SAS to sort of get around that, but a lot of people don't. And if you view source on loads of sites, you'll find, you know, all of these, this sort of row and column markup actually in the HTML. So, you know, I know you can use these frameworks in other ways and get around that, but you're seeing that a lot because that's where a lot of people are stopping. It's just putting the divs in.
And I'm sure most people listening to this podcast, I mean, we don't have a huge audience. We have an audience of people who really get web design and development. Most people listening know why it's better to, you know, to have elements like paragraph and div and aside and, you know, and footer, semantic elements that can be reused in multiple ways instead of having all these elements that are basically pictorial, because it's really no different from table layouts. I've been thinking about the web standards battles of the past, and I really see them playing out again in a strange way. I, you know, the names of what folks are doing have changed, but it's the same arguments of this is faster, this is easier. You know, HTML and CSS aren't really that real anyway. They're not that important. I've got all this JavaScript, so everything's fine. You know, and I just see maybe it's new people doing this, right? They weren't around for the first round of arguments.
Yeah, I think part of it, because you can, as I say, you mentioned Dreamweaver, and I think it's the frameworks are almost like the WYSIWYG editors of the past. Now, you know, where people were relying on WYSIWYG editors, they're now relying on the frameworks, and it's very much the same sort of thing going on. And there's also this kind of undercurrent of, oh, it's all changing really fast, and I can't keep up, and I've got to learn all this stuff. And a lot of that, I wrote an article a little while ago about, I think a lot of that fear is because people haven't got those core skills to go back to. You know, if you know HTML and you know CSS, then you can look at any framework that comes along and say, oh, yeah, I can see how that's working. I've used Bootstrap a bit. I've used Foundation. I've used Skeleton. I've used quite a few of these different frameworks, and I can switch between them quite happily because I can just, you know, go into my browser tools and have a poke around and say, oh, yeah, that's how that's working. That's what that's doing. So it's not scary, and it doesn't really matter if it's another one that comes along, because I've got CSS, you know, I understand the CSS.
It's harder, I think, for people to focus on those core skills now. People entering, I think employers are saying you need to know these 17 frameworks.
And, yes. Yeah.
And I want to make sure that you know these five CMSs and, the way they used to say 15, 20 years ago, you got to know Photoshop and Dreamweaver and Illustrator. And I mean, and it was important to know all those things too, but the fundamentals were code. I don't know if I can tell this story, but I'm going to try anyway. We were going to do, some of the folks from Event Apart were invited to give a presentation at an Apple store in a major city by a really wonderful creative director at the Apple store at that time. And Apple canceled at the last minute when they realized that we weren't going to be showing how to use any products. It wasn't going to be about Photoshop or Dreamweaver, and it didn't have to be an Apple product. But at the time, and this is a long time ago, if they were going to put some expert up on their stage, that person should be saying, here's how you do it in this tool. And for someone to go, so I opened my text editor. Right. They just didn't get it. They just didn't get it, that it was, you know, code and strategy and writing and all that. Is it premature to have done this book now, given that not every browser supports CSS grid layout yet?
Yeah, well, the very interesting thing about the development of grid layout is essentially it's developed behind a flag in browsers. So unlike Flexbox, which developed with the prefixes, and so people started to use Flexbox. And that's why we've got this kind of issue of there being multiple versions of Flexbox essentially out in the wild. And that's going to go away a bit now. The old IEs are being dropped and things. But grid's been different. Grid has been developed hidden away. And so there isn't the only actual implementation of grid, which isn't behind a flag, is the very early Internet Explorer one. Everybody else, so Firefox has got grid behind a flag. The sort of main implementation for a long time was being done in Blink. So that's there in Chrome and also in WebKit. And it's all behind a flag. You can't get it. You can't use it at the moment.
Now, when you say WebKit, you mean Chrome WebKit again.
It's in WebKit itself. Whether that'll go into Safari, so you have to use WebKit nightlies to use use Grid. But it's all sort of hidden away. So it's either in nightlies or it's behind a flag. It's not been prefixed and put out there, other than the Microsoft one, which has led to kind of a bit of confusion because people are sort of like, well, why is there only this Microsoft version and why is it not seem to have moved on? And the reason it's not moved on is that I think the IE team were then waiting, and now the Edge team are waiting for the specification to be finalized. And then they're going to, when they've said it's high priority on their backlog, to update their implementation to the new one.
The reason it's flagged is so that, so you could do, I'm going to translate this for simpler minds. Basically what you're saying is you could do a grid layout in a non-IE browser and it would work if that user went into the browser and set a flag for it, kind of like with early implementations of CSS, if anyone remembers, where it would say like, let the page author control my fonts. Remember, like that was a choice back then. That was a choice. But the reason they're doing that, I think, and you bring this out in the book, is so that we can see what works and doesn't work before it's finalized. Because, right?
Yeah. So that's the important thing about writing about this stuff, is because the problem with development behind a flag is that people don't get to play with it because they don't realize it's there, or they're sort of like, well, I can't use it in client work, so I'll not have a look. But it's really important that people like us, who are sort of, you know, what they do with SQL authors, so people who actually develop websites, it's important that we look at this stuff and we feed back to the working group, you know, how this is and isn't working. Because if we don't talk about it while the spec's in development, then we can't make changes to it. And we can't say, hey, look, this doesn't work very well.
And we can't complain. We'll be like people who don't like the government but don't vote.
Yeah,
if you
exactly,
don't vote, then shut up.
So, and that's really why I started talking about it and writing about it, because I thought this is important and I want more people like me. And actually, I really wanted more people who are, say, more design focused, because I'm a developer.
Right.
And I wanted people who were designers to look at it and say, well, this is a problem and that's a problem. And it's quite difficult to get people to do that, which is why, you know, I've been getting up on stage and talking about it. And because then I get to hear what people think. Even if they wouldn't, say, create a test case themselves or whatever.
Now, I've seen you give this presentation, and you're going to be giving it again at an event apart. I've seen you do this, and it thrilled me because some part of my mind that had shut down to CSS, I used to be so excited. Like, when I started, I would, like, dream in GIFs. I would dream in 16 colors, and I could have long philosophical debates about how, you know, tabs versus spaces in market. And partly I got older, younger people come along who are doing more of that work. I rose in the ranks of my own company and I'm doing less hands-on work. But also I think I got overwhelmed, like a lot of people are feeling now, because there's so much to learn. There's all these frameworks. And I went from going, you know, people used to say, do you use this framework? I go, well, I use a framework called CSS. And another one, I didn't really say that, but that's what I thought. I was like, I use one called HTML. Have you heard of it? Yeah, I like that one, but you know, okay. So I just got discouraged and I was like, this is so many hacks and so much work and, you know, things like has layout and all these things we had to do turned me off. Mm. Like I didn't want standards to come out so that things would be more complicated. I wanted things to make more sense and be more rational. Instead, they were just crazy in a different way. But now, as I watch you give this talk, I can even tune out the exact words you're saying. Like as you start to show the code, I mean, I look at it and go, yeah, I could write that. And then I look away and just like the music of it is I can do real layout with very simple. That's huge. It's exciting to me. And it makes me think we can also maybe like, the kind of things Jen Simmons has been talking about, right? Start breaking away from these simple boxy layouts and be more creative.
Well, that to me is the exciting thing really is once, because, you know, we talk about whether it's too early to be talking about this stuff. It's the thing is when Grid actually gets out there into browsers, it's going to get out as a very complete implementation because everybody's been working away at it behind a flag and kind of ironing out the problems and things. So hopefully what we'll get when it does land is something which isn't full of bugs and isn't problematic in the way that Flexbox was. Nobody wants a sort of repeat of how that kind of came to be.
Or CSS 2.0.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. You know,
they were scientists designing in a vacuum. browsers didn't support what they were saying, and they weren't talking to designers, and designers weren't pushing and pulling and testing it and going, oh, see, I would have done it this way.
Yeah, well, that's it. I think this sort of idea of things emerging behind flags, as long as we can get people to look at them and play with them and start to be creative with it before it is finished, I think it works quite well. So I think it's good for people to start looking at this now, because when it lands, it's going to be usable, and it's going to be usable quite quickly.
So we're going to have to go to a sponsorship break in just a second. But so one takeaway that I have is, everyone listening, buy this book, turn those flags on in your browser, experiment with it, see if you like it. And if you find a problem or something seems dumb or inexplicable, now's the time to speak up. You'll be doing a service not just for other people, but for yourself, because then for the next 5 or 10 years, this is probably how you're going to be designing websites.
Yeah.
Okay, and I have to take a quick sponsorship break, which is always a pleasure to do. Today's Big Web Show is brought to you by A List Apart for people who make websites. Since 1998, A List Apart has explored the design, development, and meaning of web content with a special focus on web standards and best practices. From a DAO of web design to the end of table layouts, from lists for navigation to working with alternative style sheets, from accessibility to readability, and from the holy grail of CSS layout to sliding doors to responsive web design and beyond, A List Apart has long been a leading voice of web design and development, and it's your voice, the voice of this community. Currently in A List Apart, CSS Blending Modes Demystified by Justin Dowell, The Perfect Storm in Digital Law by Heather Burns, and Interaction is an Enhancement by Aaron Gustafson. Stay in the game and ahead of the curve at alistapart.com. That's alistapart.com for people who make websites. And we are back with alistapart.com columnist, Perch co-founder, longtime standardista. Rachel Andrew, you were on the team that brought web standards to Dreamweaver in like 2001.
It was something like that. Yeah. Yes, it was a long time ago.
That's and they were nice people, and like I don't want to belittle Dreamweaver's achievement. I mean, there's a reason it was a very popular tool. It was very powerful, but that was to get those folks to and how did you? I mean, you prioritized, right? You said. You did this with Drew, right?
Yes, yeah, the two of us. And really, we just kind of sat on the beta and complained a lot and pointed out where there were problems and just tried to sort of edge the product. I mean,
invite you in? Did you come approach them?
Well, we'd kind of already been doing Dreamweaver stuff, because it was Drew McClellan got me into using Dreamweaver in the first place, because I was just hand coding. I was like a notepad girl, you know? And so we'd started using it, and then got into web standards and like, hang on, you know, this isn't great. You know, if you this button that says indent, it's adding a block quote, you know, things like that. And so then, you know, coming on board with the web standards project and sort of formalizing what we were kind of starting to do already, it kind of gave us, I guess, a little bit more sort of authority when we were working in the beta and things like that. And,
also, I mean, in a way, I think web standards took it out of opinion. So before that, you could, because you were a purist or something,
yes,
you'd go like,
exactly, yeah.
Yeah, I wish Dreamweaver wouldn't do these absolutely positioned smitsics, or every time it does a paragraph, it makes a new font tag. That seems wasteful somehow. But there wasn't anything to grab hold of. There was a sense that it was wrong. But then again, what should it be doing? But then once we're all on board with web standards, that's like you define a paragraph style and you reuse it. And in that way, you save bandwidth and you're serving only the code you need to serve, not a bunch of extra junk. It became, instead of just a purist snobbery of developers, it became there's a rationale for this and it's user focused.
Yeah. And they were always really great at Macromedia. They were, you know, they were interested and they listened, and that, you know, they were always, once you could kind of make a good case for anything, they'd be like, all right, okay, yeah. And, you know, it would be accepted. So, yeah, it was good fun.
Macromedia.
Ah. Times passed. You see, all the kids will be like, who? Yeah.
Can we talk about David Bowie for 5 minutes? I'm crushed.
Yeah. He's someone who's sort of so timeless that you couldn't imagine, you know, you couldn't really sort of think about how old you might be, or, you know, there are some sort of people in the public eye who, you know, you're watching them on television, and Drew and I do this, you know, we're watching telly and I say, oh, how old do you think they are now?
You know, right.
Then we're on Wikipedia having a look to see how old. And there are people who seem to be of their age, and you're like, oh yes, you know, they're one of that group of old actors, or, you know, that you see in films and things. And whereas, yeah, Bowie was just like timeless, completely timeless.
Also alien because of that injury to his eye, right, that made his eyes appear to be two different colors, even though they weren't. And his thinness and his, he didn't seem, I mean, got to remember when he came out, it was the hippie era. Every other band had super long hair parted in the middle and mustaches and beards on the guys. And you know, and Bowie came out like wearing a dress, and then he came out as Ziggy Stardust. And it was just,
yeah.
I mean, when I went to high school, if you weren't in a sport, you basically got beat up and called queer.
Yes.
And that was a terrible, everyone was so scared, you know. And then this guy, he didn't care what people thought. He was proud of himself. He was, he was actually, I think, a lot less bi than he appeared to be, but he didn't care what people thought, and he was proud, and it was mind-boggling. Mm. And he was so great. He did stuff like mime. I mean, he was just so, he brought theater into music and a kind of honesty, even though, and also this weird, like, art. I don't want to say artistic because that always seems pretentious in rock, but he really was an artist who just used rock, I think.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, I think so. And yeah, and then that sort of whole reinvention and being able to stay current and still speak to people of all different ages. And just, I mean, just like watching people on, you know, I've been reading Twitter today, you know, and I was sort of online early this morning in UK time when the sort of news broke, and then you just sort of saw everybody starting to tweet and mention things, and just the different ages of everybody. It wasn't just older people saying, right, oh, this is someone from our youth. You know, sometimes people die who are that sort of age, and it'll be
like if someone from Fleetwood Mac were to die, you'd expect probably older people to be going,
yes, oh, that,
you wouldn't necessarily expect 20-year-olds to know who that is or care.
Yeah, and people's kids, you know, really young people mentioning it, because that music is sort of timeless, and he was timeless. And that's, you know, very sad. One of those people you'd expect just to always be there. I think a lot of people were saying, oh, couldn't imagine that he would die, as if he was other, you know, not the same as us.
Right. That was the alien thing. And also just, and he wasn't that old, and he didn't look that old, and he didn't sound. His new album came out like 2 days ago.
Yes.
And it sounds amazing. It's beautiful. Yeah. It doesn't sound like, I don't know. I mean, I don't want to insult anyone, but like if David Crosby were to come out with an album now, it would probably sound kind of like Crosby, Stills, Nash, but not as good. It would be sort of that, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Sort of like they do this thing and they keep doing the thing, but it becomes less connected to its time.
Like, yes. Yeah.
And he never did that. He was always reinventing.
Yeah, I think that's it. I think it's that reinvention thing and being able to stay sort of young in what you do.
Mentally.
In your craft, being able to stay young and excited about what it is, you know, that you're doing. And I think, you know, he was someone who did that.
Here's a crude segue, but you and I to some extent, but definitely you do that in your craft. You're constantly reinventing, you're changing your focus, learning new technologies, and you're not, I know a lot of people who've been doing this as long as you and I have, who are kind of burned out, and you never seem burned out. You just seem perpetually excited. And so what's the secret of that for someone maybe listening who is starting to feel like, oh, I'm so tired of this. I'm tired of web design. I don't want to learn a new thing, or whatever it is that's discouraging them. How do you reinvent yourself or keep your mind fresh, keep open-minded.
I think I've been fortunate because I work for myself. I've never ended up in a position where I think a lot of people of my age, I mean, I'm 40 now, and a lot of people of my age have ended up kind of managers. And I think it's a lot harder if you're not hands-on code and you don't have an opportunity to be hands-on code to do that, you know, to sort of still keep excited about things. So just the way I work has helped, I think. But yeah,
because it's magical when you make stuff.
Yes. Well, that's it. It's making things and it's learning how to do interesting things has always been, you know, it's why I got into this in the first place. You know, I've got no background in this. I've got, you know, no training. Right. I'm an ex-dancer. I sort of fell into it because I wanted to put my baby photos online. I just, you know, I was pregnant and I was poking around learning the internet. And then I sort of, had my daughter, I wanted to get my baby photos online. That's why I learned to build a website.
What a wonderful story.
And it's, you know, it's, but back then I was on these sort of parenting forums, and this is 97, so 96, 97. And I was on these parenting forums, and of course there was no Flickr, there was no Facebook, there was nowhere. If you wanted to put your baby photos online, you had to build a website. So In these parenting forums, there were forums about HTML. And everyone was teaching each other, you know, oh, if you put this in, you know, you open up Notepad and you paste this in, you can put a picture in and explaining how to do it. And so I just learned how to do it. And then it was so interesting that I carried on learning how to do it, you know, and learning new things as things appeared. And I'm still like that. You know, it's why I got into Grid. You know, I'm like, oh, this looks interesting. You know, like, what can we do with it?
You're so onto something, because I was so excited when I was all hands on all the time. And as I've started businesses and gotten into more strategic or managerial positions, it's harder to keep that excitement. Mm. I remember the first website I worked on, there were two other guys I worked on it with, and Alec Pollock and Steve McCarron. And a year later, I met up with Alec, who was now a creative director at a place because of the success of that website. And I was showing him CSS, which at the time, it was IE3's CSS gallery. This is 1996. I said, this is the future. I was so excited. And he looked at me and he didn't get why it was exciting, because he had known the most about HTML of anyone on that team when we started. But then he'd gotten promoted out of hands-on work. Mm-hmm. So he wasn't, you know, and Alec's a great guy. We stay in touch. He's a brilliant guy. But I remember thinking, wow, I hope that never happens to me. I hope that I never lose touch with these hand skills. Mm. And but when I think about when I've seen your presentation on CSS Grid Layout, when I read your book on CSS Grid Layout, I think this is what's going to bring me back in, because this seems like the most rational, especially this will be the one that's been torture tested by developers and works correctly in all browsers. This will be the one where that's designed for real layouts. It's designed for a world where there's responsiveness as a given. Mm. It's multi-column as a given, but columns can change, right? It works with media queries.
Yeah.
It's designed for the world we're in, just like HTML5 is designed for the web world that we're in.
Yeah, and I think the exciting thing is going to be, and I think that, you know, Jen Simmons is right about this, that, you know, it's when creative people get their hands on this, because everyone at the moment really who's playing with this stuff are people like me who are developers, you know, and I look at things in a certain way, you know, in terms of, and you know, I look at things and how they're going to benefit content management, because that's what I do. And whereas I really want designers and creative people to get their hands on this stuff and say, you know, what exciting things can we do if we're freed from just figuring out how to even make it work? Because at the moment, you expend so many mental cycles just working out how to get it to work at all and not be a mess, that there's no time to be creative. You know, it's like, this works, you know, it's don't touch it, it's working. Once we don't have to worry about that so much, then people can start to really, you know, push the boundaries of what can be done, because they know that the CSS is there, that the layout stuff is there to support what they want to do.
It's funny. I remember a period where everyone doing web design was a hybrid designer developer. This is what I was.
Yeah. Right?
So didn't necessarily have a design school background. right, I had not designed a business card. I mean, I had done some ad layouts in Quark, but nothing like super precise. Those always got finalized. Back in that day, you'd send your layout to someone else who would actually make it really work in a newspaper, even though, right? So I'd never done like final production of anything. And that's why I loved HTML, because like now I can do that. Now I don't have to wait for some guy who's on his lunch break when I'm still excited about the thing and I just want to see it get out there.
Yeah.
Right. Where was I going with that? I have no idea.
I think, yeah, it actually reminds me, as you were saying, it reminds me as an agency, we used to chop up like people's designs to get them ready for the web.
Yes.
I mean, do you remember that occurring?
Sure. The genius of Dreamweaver and Photoshop was now you don't have to manually chop up your Photoshop comps, right?
Yeah. Yeah. For a while, fireworks, you could export out of fireworks a sort of ready chopped up thing and a nasty table layout to put it all in.
I remember where I was going now. I was trying to connect so many ideas at once that I blanked out, I blacked out. But okay, there was this period where everything was being done by people like us, hybrids who had sort of given themselves background in design, given themselves background in code, hadn't gone to school necessarily for either. And then it got more professional and some people with graphic design and interaction design backgrounds came in. And they designed differently because they weren't aware of the limitations. Every time I did a CSS layout, I was doing something I already knew how to do, right? I was going, I know how to do this now, and I know how to make a nav like this, and I know how to make a footer like that. And these people came in, and I was like, you can't have this thing that goes all the way across the top. You can't have this thing. You can't have a background color that goes all the way to the bottom of the page. That's crazy talk. There's just going to be what, you know, you can't do that. And they were like, why not? Well, and then it changed the way we designed. And then like having to work with people who had a better graphic design background than me made me go back and up my game because, well, I'm not going to let them do all the creative stuff. And okay, they're right. So I'm going to design as if I don't know how this code works, and then I'll figure out how to do that. And I would say like 2002, 2003, maybe when like people like Cameron Mall were really becoming voices in our field. And it was like, okay, there was like this increase of quality in design of websites because of the presence of those people and what they spurred the original people to do. And I think that's going to happen again was the point of my long story.
Yeah.
With folks like Jen showing these incredible magazine layouts and saying, why can't we do this on the web? And folks like you saying, here we can look, right? With Flexbox, which a lot of people are using, but much more so to me with grid layout.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, because there's been a sort of interesting things happened where, you know, people are saying, again, as they were at the beginning of the sort of CSS layout sort of movement, people were saying, oh, all the websites look the same.
Right.
And it's happened again with responsive because the easiest way to make something responsive is to do the kind of standard bootstrap layout look, isn't it? You know, you have your big image at the top and then you have centered text, you know, in a central column and go to one column and things. And so there's this look of websites of now. And yeah, they have become very, very samey. We're seeing the same things. And I think I think will happen as grid comes out is that people will say, hey, we can do something different now. And hopefully people will start to get their hands on it and start, you know, creating a new language, a new visual language for what we can do online.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Remember Your CSS Bores Me by Chris Casciano?
I think I wrote a response to that. I've got that somewhere. I shall find it.
Every day for a month, he would do a completely off the wall layout of the same content.
Yeah.
Right. And remember like the excitement around Dave Shea's CSS Zen Garden?
Yeah.
For years, by the way, for years. Like, and people who up to that point hadn't given the slightest of, I was going to say a bad word. So I'll just say who didn't care about CSS at all and didn't see what the fuss was about were suddenly going, oh, wow, I can make this look like Attack of the Mole People, or I can make it look like an ancient book. That's amazing.
Yeah, and there was a time when we would put like little like layout switches on our website, so you could change the layout, just to show that this can be done, this is possible. It wasn't, there was no real use for this.
Jeremy Keefe still does it.
Yeah.
And they're all like old fixed width layouts too, which is like, Jeremy, please, one fresh one. But no, I remember the day that I realized that the layout switcher could actually be used for accessibility. Okay, if I really think that light brown type on a beige background is a good idea at, in 8-point Verdana, okay, but maybe make another one for someone who'd like to read who doesn't have perfect, vision.
Yeah, that's it. And for a long time, that was kind of how we did it. And a lot of that, I think, was to do with you couldn't resize pixel fonts in IE for a long time and things. So we were doing those font size switcher things, weren't we, and things like that.
And you couldn't do relative because of browser bugs. If you tried to make everything relative, it would, like, one browser would go, this is relative to the containing box, and the other would go, this is relative to the base font. And, like, there was no agreement among browser makers, and so...
Yeah, it was bizarre, and people think they've got it bad now.
The kids have no idea.
I know. I like to talk about these things, and I'll often ask you. I'll be doing a presentation. I'll say, so who built a website here for Netscape 4? And there'll be like sort of three hands go up and a sort of wry smile.
I remember with IE6, maybe if you I do a layout that was a perfect CSS layout in all browsers, and then I'd italicize a word, and the way IE calculated the italics, first it would calculate the character width, then it would apply the italics, and for some reason, instead of making it narrower, like a true italic, it made a fake italic that made the line wider. The line length now exceeded the containing box by like 2 pixels, and as a result, the whole layout broke. Right? And I was like, well, we can't use italics. Oh, yeah. Web design with standards is much better. I've written a whole book on the subject. We have to do it this way. Table layouts are terrible. CSS is the way to go. Just don't use italics. italics. Well.
Yeah, and the peekaboo thing where like bits of your layout would just disappear.
I have no idea. Again, I got so I think part of my drifting toward more strategic stuff was just I don't want to learn all these workarounds. This is not what standards was supposed to be.
It was what we became was really kind of like browser bug experts.
Jeff Croft wrote about that.
Yeah, that's what we were doing.
He even said, "Oh, now the browsers are good enough that we're going to be out of a job."
Yeah, right. Well, that's it. I hope we could do something more interesting now. I do wonder, all of this sort of focus on tooling and making front end into kind of some sort of engineering discipline and what have you. I think a lot of that is because people have got time to do that now. We're not just working around browsers doing crazy things.
I am writing down what you said, right? Making front end into an engineering discipline because we have the time. Because we finally have the time, because we're not spending all our time working around browser bugs.
Yeah, I mean, because we were. I mean, we just spent a ridiculous amount of time. Every time you did, you'd do something that's slightly different, you'd have to then figure out exactly what had been triggered by whatever it was you're doing.
Which, again, is what led to all these websites look the same. There's two reasons. One is functional. Right. Like all these suits look the same. They have 2 or 3 buttons on them and they have lapels. Yes, because the men who wear them tend to have chests and arms. Right. So these websites are doing similar functions. Right.
Yeah.
Main content. Here's how to find our other content. Call to action. Like the strategy behind a lot of these businesses is painfully the same. I mean, that's part of it.
Well, yeah, and that's it. And also, I think a lot of people, I mean, speaking as a businesswoman, you're always, you're building a website, but it's often to sell something or promote something. And we don't have the resources of a big company. So if I'm looking at a big company and they're doing and they're being successful, I'm saying, well, this call to action works for them, doing it like that works for them. And so I think we're all doing that, aren't we? We're all, it's why, you know, shopping carts all look a bit like Amazon.
Right.
Because we're all like, well, they've obviously done the research, you know, that this works.
And their Amazon is one of those stories. In a way, everything they do is wrong. Mm. It's cluttered. It's hard. I mean, their apps are great. I can always find what I want in 2 seconds on the app. But once they have screen real estate, I guess they have so many competing divisions and departments and so many multiple site goals. Like, we want the user to buy just one thing. I mean, these five things.
Yes.
Right? It's like trying to run a newspaper where you have a headline and like, war is declared, but there's also a space probe. Perhaps you'd rather read about that. Maybe you'll come back to the war. It's like, so Amazon does that, but we still, in spite of that, they're incredibly successful and we imitate all the things we can. I can't really imitate a store. I can't really put down a brick and mortar store for them. Like they have a thing. Think about it. I see something I want. I hold my phone in front of it. My phone takes a picture. It goes up in a satellite. Instantaneously, Amazon checks a database and goes, oh, yeah, we have that product. And then they open the store on 34th Street in Manhattan, because I'm based in Manhattan, and a guy on a bicycle can bring it to my house. It's still at the very end, right? It's all this technology and satellites and data, big data and recognition, like a million kinds of advanced engineering. And then at the end, it's a guy on a bicycle.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. That's amazing to me.
Yeah. I mean, it is. And if you think back to like when, you know, when we started with the web, just to imagine how things have changed and what we're actually doing with it. I mean, it would have been unimaginable, really, just the pace of how much it's changed.
Yes. I start to feel like my grandfather.
Yes.
He's like, landing on the moon. We didn't even have butter in a store. We had to make our own butter. What do you mean landing on the moon? Radios that you can carry. The radios are as big as the living room. What do you mean radios you can carry in your pocket?
Yeah, that'd be us. We're going to need some kind of old folks home for old web people. We can sit in there.
Soon.
Sit and shout at each other.
Soon for me. I have to take a quick sponsor break and we'll be right back. Today's Big Web Show is brought to you by An Event Apart, 3 days of design, code, and content for web and interaction designers and developers. And we'll let those designers and developers write the commercial. It's more than just a conference, but an awesome experience as well, says Susan Simpkins, web design instructor for Digital Tutors. By far the most valuable conference I have attended, says Art Dzniski, UI designer for Pearson Education. A great intersection between new tech and staying grounded, says David Lim, senior web developer for Vernier Software and Technology. The best conference out there. Tons of great info and no sales pitch, says Ellen Holiday. Catch An Event Apart this year in Nashville, Seattle, Boston, D.C., Chicago, and San Francisco, or join us for the 3-day special edition at Walt Disney World, Orlando. Big Web Show listeners save $100 with discount code AEABWS16. That's number 16. AEA for An Event Apart, BWS for Big Web Show, 16 for 2016. Enter discount code AEABWS16 to support the Big Web Show and save $100 when you register for any An Event Apart 2 or 3 day event in 2016. For 30 hours of free web design videos and to learn more about AEA, visit aneventapart.com today. And thank you, sponsors. We are done with sponsors. Back to the show. You know, the first CSS I ever saw was IE3 image CSS gallery. Did you see that? That was like 1996.
I remember seeing that. Yeah.
I'm sure it was monstrous CSS. Like, they did drop shadows by typing the word 4 times. And using absolute positioning to position.
That's right.
So they were doing. But I remember back then I was really worried about bandwidth, right? Like we are today, but then because of modems. Mm-hmm. And I was like, how can I fill a screen with color and with as little code as possible? How can I make huge type with as little code as possible? I don't really want to take pictures of type and show pictures of type. Mm-hmm. I wasn't even thinking about accessibility in 1996. I wish I had, but I wasn't. But I was thinking, I don't want to show a picture of text when I can just use text. I mean, mm-hmm. isn't that the point? And then Microsoft, of all people, came out with a CSS gallery. They hired these designers. The stuff looked magical. And that changed my life, I think. Mm. Do you remember, you're talking about getting into HTML and web design because you had a baby on the way and you wanted to learn to make websites so you could share baby pictures with your yeah. family because there was yeah. no other way. Do you remember the first time you encountered CSS and did it have any impact on you in terms of like, oh my God, this is what I want to do? Or
I think it was the first really stuff I was seeing was the kind of, you know, replace your font tags. And I always just took this very, I was quite lucky in the resources I encountered when I learned HTML. And so I was just very keen that everything should be very clean and tidy and neat. And I'm that sort of person anyway. I like things to be organized. And that's why I've gone more into development. And, you know, I've got that sort of way of thinking. And so when I saw CSS, I thought, oh, this is great. You know, less stuff in the actual page and more in this one file. And that made sense. Mm-hmm. Because very quickly after I got into web development at all, I started teaching myself Perl. So I started learning a programming language as well. And I was kind of thinking in that way and trying to reuse things. And that was really what excited me most about CSS was the fact that, oh, I would be able to tidy things up.
Yep.
So that was really where first came. The thing I can remember seeing that I was amazed by was actually JavaScript. It was the first time I saw like a rollover image with JavaScript. Yes. It was like, what magic is this?
Was it inline JavaScript?
It was some horrible, horrible, horrible stuff we were writing. Yeah. But I remember seeing that.
I loved that stuff because you could view source and just steal it.
Yes. Yeah. That's what we were all doing.
Right.
But it was, I remember seeing this thinking, wow, you know, you can move your mouse over the page and something happens, you know. That was excellent. I had to learn that immediately, you know.
And moving stuff. I remember Cool Site of the Day by Glenn Davis. The next thing he started was Project Cool, and he did this DHTML thing figures were moving on the page behind text. And I was just, jaw on the floor.
Yeah, and there was a whole range of horrendous things, like those mouse trails that would follow your mouse around and falling snow.
We're much more sophisticated now in the dumb, unnecessary things we add to websites. They're a lot classier than the dumb, unnecessary things we did back then. But the thing is, we were so much more excited back then.
Yeah, I think we were. I mean, what we could do was so limited that every little thing that came along that we were able to do was just massively exciting. And we all did it, you know?
Plus, back then, if you had any sort of content, you could get the whole web's attention.
Oh, yeah.
Because there was so little out there. There was there are wonderful people, right? Heather Champ, Derek Pawazik. There was Glassdog by Lance Arthur. Anybody that had kind of a cool idea that wasn't commercial that put it up there, they would probably find readers and recognition almost immediately, which now, even with a huge budget, it's much harder to do.
Yeah, and it was interesting as well because we didn't kind of – I mean, these days you kind of know what everyone looks like. You see an awful lot more of their sort of personal life, you know, through Twitter and Facebook and all that. And we didn't really have that. It was very much about the work people were doing.
Yep.
Much more than about them as personalities. And I think now we have a bit more of people following kind of personalities online rather than just looking at the work.
This is like rock music before and after MTV.
I guess so, yeah. Because we now know so much about people. You know, I'll meet someone for the first time at a conference. They'll know a huge amount about me. They'll know I've got a daughter. They'll know that I like running, that I do all these sort of personal things, which aren't anything to do with the work that I do. Because, well, that's out there too, because I sort of live my life online, you know.
Me too.
But we didn't have that before. I mean, people didn't know what people looked like, even. Yeah, you'd meet someone for the first time, and you would actually not know. Like, well, how will I recognize you? You know, We didn't have pictures up there.
But also, I think there were a lot of like blues artists and funk artists and like heavy metal. There were a lot of people that weren't necessarily gorgeous and couldn't dance, but they had something, right? There were people, I mean, Bob Dylan couldn't sing, David Byrne couldn't sing. There was a whole lot of people that were great, but didn't, their genius was what they could bring to the medium, but not like what they looked like or all that stuff. And I think now people have fake asses. You can't even get a video out without a fake ass. My daughter's really upset with Adele because like she looked like Adele and now she sort of was like, here's a real person, not like a supermodel, right? Not a movie star, but just a regular person that you can relate to who has this amazing voice and writes these songs that break your heart. And she's wonderful. And then she's like, okay. And I don't blame her at all. But now that I've got some money, I'll get plastic surgery, get my teeth fixed and everything. And now I'm not as real.
Yeah.
I'm joining the ranks of the, you know, you, if you liked me because I was real, guess what? Now that I have some money, I'm like everybody else that has money and I'm going to be look perfect and be slightly plastic. And, yeah.
Yeah. And I think we see some of that in, you know, even our own industry, you know, that people have to be a bit more of a personality. Than just good at the work they do. Whereas, you know, when I started, you didn't know what anyone looked like and it was about the work. You know, there were people who you weren't even sure if they were male or female. You know, they were just doing the work. Whereas now it is very much about, well, you know, sort of conference speakers and things. And there are certain people who you'd see as being a bit of a personality. And you kind of have to be that if you're going to.
You have to be that.
Yeah, you have to do that. You have to play. I mean, you know, I'm really an introvert. You know, I'm most happy on my own, working away on some stuff.
Me too.
But in order to be able to talk about the interesting things and to share stuff and to get feedback, you know, I'm doing the public speaking, which I enjoy. But there's a step where you have to learn and work at doing that.
I hid behind Jeff Veen the first time Linda from now Linda.com, Linda at the time, Linda Weinman, who just had some books out, invited Jeff Veen and George Olson and me to speak about web standards in 1998, maybe at a CES conference. I hid behind Jeff Veen, which is easy to do because he's large and I'm tiny. But I was terrified.
Yeah.
I had nothing. I was like, You talk. But you have to get over that to survive in this business.
Yeah, I think you have to be willing to do it. And it's hard, though. I mean, there's bound to be video of me out there where I'm absolutely shaking, terrified of speaking. It's taken a lot of practice to get to a point where I can get on stage and feel okay about it, you know.
If you go to an event apart and go to the news feed a couple stories back, there's a video, very short video of Eric Meyer and Jason Santa Maria and me doing our first event apart conference. And you can't really tell because the camera's far enough away, but Jason was shaking the whole time, reading his thing out loud. Now he's one of the greatest speakers I've ever seen. He blows me away. He's a much better speaker than I am. I love watching the guy. He seems relaxed and confident and like he's just having fun and sharing. But man, you know, so I got to watch people I know go through it.
It is practice. I mean, for anyone who's sort of thinking, oh, I could never do it. I thought I could never do it for a long time. Yep. I would write, but I would never go and speak. And it's just practice. A lot of it is.
It helps to have a spectacular failure or two and survive. Like I spoke at Geek Pride. I was the ultimate speaker and the penultimate speaker was Commander Taco, the founder of Slashdot. And he was 20. The audience was 20 and they were all Linux geeks. He came on stage, he knocked it out of the ballpark and then he said, let's all get drunk. And they all left the auditorium. The whole audience left except for like three old people who were confused. And I had to go on stage anyway and give my talk. And I was like, I was like, okay, well that didn't kill me. So
yeah.
And another time I was giving a talk at a conference in New York. It was a photography conference that wanted to be an internet conference, but they didn't know how to reach an internet audience and they didn't know how to advertise the internet audience. So I was giving a talk on advanced CSS to what should have been a room full of photographers, but instead was like four photographers, but they'd given me the biggest room in the place. It's a Javits Center. And I had a friend visiting from Istanbul who brought his girlfriend. That was the two of the four people. The guy was like, I want you to see my friend Jeffrey Zeldman. He's so smart and he's very, very respected in his own country of America. And they come in like, I'm in an empty auditorium and like two people, the other two people get up and leave about 5 minutes into the talk. I was like, has anyone ever done any web design? Like, I just wanted to, after a while, I realized, so, you know, you survive that.
Yeah, I've had the major. It was technical failures I was always terrified of, but I've had things like my laptop rebooting on stage or the microphone stopping working or you know all those things. And yeah, you get through them and you're like, oh yeah, that wasn't so bad. You know,
do you dance? Okay. I mean, when the microphone fails, do you dance? What do you do?
When the microphone fails, I fall back on the if they haven't got another one, I'll fall back on my theatre training and project as best I can to the audience. But yeah, I've had various things. And the funniest was I was because I broke my arm really badly a few years ago, and so I went to Kung Fu in Canada, and I was one armed. I had my arm in a sling, and I was one armed. And I turned up. I've got my clicker in my good hand, and they try and hand me a handheld mic, and I'm like, "What am I going to do with that?" You know, I'm one armed. I've got one arm in a sling. I'm like, I can't have a microphone and a clicker.
They didn't have a stand. So
I sent them off to find something else, and they eventually returned with a lapel mic. But it was just like the guy's handing it to me and I'm like, what am I gonna do with that?
Wow, that's, people don't pay attention.
But yeah, it was funny. But yeah, that was I was there I broke my arm falling in the snow in the UK, and I was there in Canada where they've got like 6 foot.
You land in the snow?
Yeah, I landed on a straight arm and shattered my elbow.
Oh gosh.
Okay. So, but I was there 6 weeks later in Canada, where of course they have actual snow, real snow, not like our inch of it in the UK. And so I
have relatives in Montreal. We used to go there every Christmas. Why Christmas? I don't know. It was fun. When I was a little kid, it was fun because the snow was over my head.
Yeah. Well, that's it. I've never seen anything like it because it's, yeah, Confuse Montreal. I mean, lovely place, but yeah, that winter, I don't think I could live through that.
Well, especially now.
Yeah.
I just, you know, every year when the cold weather starts, I basically catch a cold in November that lasts until about April of the next year. It's just, that's the way it is. And every year I think, I love New York, but what am I doing?
Yeah.
Maybe.
My parents live upstate and I know a lot of the people there, you know, my mum works in the church and a lot of the congregation then go down sort of to warmer climates for the winter, which you can understand if you don't need to be there.
Yeah. I met a designer recently in Chicago, very famous, great designer. I had never met him before. A mutual friend introduced me but he was on his way to Florida. It was like, he loves Chicago, but he's, you know, he's 60. He's not going to stay in Chicago for the winter anymore. Like, that was fine when he was 30, then not anymore.
Yeah, I mean, that's the, at least in the UK, our weather's nothing to write home about. It's mainly just sort of grey and damp over the winter, but it doesn't get too cold. So
you guys start celebrating Christmas in like October, though, which is nice. I mean, the lights go up.
Yes.
See, in America, we have this Thanksgiving holiday.
Yeah.
So we can't put any Christmas stuff up until like after that. But you guys, like, I visit London in October and I'm like, oh, it's Christmas.
Yeah, it starts really early. And it's because in America, because I was in America for Halloween this year. So, because you have the Halloween stuff, which we do a little bit, but not very much.
Oh, you
so
don't go crazy with it?
No. I mean, people will do, they'll do a pumpkin or something, but it's not a big deal here. And what we do have is kind of an Americanized thing. You know, we sort of get some of that American tradition has started coming over. But yeah, we don't have Thanksgiving. So really, after Halloween, it's full on Christmas then for 2 months. You know?
That's great. That's a lot of fun. It makes the miserable weather more bearable. Once that's over, then you just have 3 more months of snow. And I mean, even in Stockholm, you have beauty. Like in Scandinavia, it's much it's cold, but they have
it's pretty snow, isn't it?
It is, and they know how to deal with it. They go. Yeah. We've built our culture knowing that half the year we're in this. But the East Coast of America, man. I don't know.
No, it's not good. And especially having fallen and smashed up my arm in the snow, I'm very, very nervous of it now. So I'm like creeping around.
Yeah, yeah, I get that. I protect parts of my body too from like previous walk around. Like, yeah.
Once you've realized you're breakable, it's
yeah. Like, yeah. We have to go. I am so sorry. This is wonderful. It has been wonderful, and I hope we'll do it again soon. The book is Get Ready for CSS Grid Layout. CSS Grid Layout really needs your support. The more designers who play with it by turning on those flags in Chrome and in IE, the more designers who play with it as it matures and basically help the W3C debug it, the sooner we will have, finally, 25 years into web design, a robust visual language for the web. The author is Rachel Andrew, co-founder of Perch. Thank you for your time today.
Yeah, it's been fun.
Wonderful. And we'll see everybody on another Big Web Show soon. Mm-hmm.